Too much information is going to be starting a little late this evening. Holiday-style transportation. So I'm going to back announce really slowly, and it's a good thing too, because there were a lot of songs in that set. There's one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 11, and 12. There were 12 songs, and the 12th one we heard was very short, mastered very hot, because that's what you gotta do. If you're a kid making tunes now, master it really hot. So everybody notices, even when you come after the dirt bombs, which master it not so hot, but sounds better. I still like the track by Ivan the Tolerable, and I'm a big fan of the name, Ivan the Tolerable. The Frame in the Cellar was the name of the song from a split CD with Kaleidoscope Death. Preceding it, as earlier mentioned, was music from the Dirt Bombs, Mick Collins and crew. Consistency is the enemy. Here comes that sound again. Lava Children made a record with a sailfish on the cover. It is self-titled, and Irwin gave it to me. I cannot tell if we heard Tree Speak 2 or some other tune. Before that, a good friend to the radio station, Pete Gallup, is. He came down to stuff envelopes this Saturday, and he's long made some fine music as well. He's made a new record. It's called Candy Tears. Came with a guitar pick, customized. I'll use mine tonight. Practicing with the Hoof and Mouth Sinfonia for the marathon finale, which comes up 4 weeks from today when the marathon ends with a big party. But don't forget to volunteer for the marathon first by emailing me, scott@wfmu.org. And don't forget to pledge at the marathon time. It starts in 2 weeks. Pete Gallup made a CD called Candy Tears. Did I mention it came with a custom guitar pick? I'll be using mine tonight at Hoof and Mouth Sinfonia practice. The first one, Crying Time, was the name of the song by Pete. Pete Gallup, the fella's name, came out of music from Widow's Peak. Widow's Peak, that's a thing. Is Widow Speak a thing? I don't know. I'm gonna call them Widow's Peak. The song was called Devil Knows, and it came from their new disc entitled Almanac. Yola Tango's got a fine new one out. Yes, it's called Fade. And the last track on Fade was recorded by James in Hoboken just before the cops dragged him away. Before We Run was its title. And Jacko Gardner has made a fine pop record entitled Cabinet of Curiosities. From it we heard Where Will You Go? Before We Run, Devil Knows. Veronica Falls before that. Waiting for something to happen. Last Conversation was the name of the song. The name of the song before that was Strange Rituals. Shadows was the name of the LP. And the band was known as Mastodon. Linnea Espera made a record, called it Linnea Espera. Put a song in the number 3 spot. Decided to call it Preservation Bias. And then, way back in 1979, a bunch of misfits living in San Francisco heard about the residents, and then they met a guy, another guy. His name was Moritz, and he was from Dusseldorf. Moritz of Dusseldorf. And Greg and Sharon of San Francisco went to San Jose, California. And then they enlisted others in this project where they all played instruments that weren't really instruments. And they made a record featuring them and their friends, most famous of them being Der Plan, and the world famous Ensenada, also involved with the record somehow. Well, we heard Die Carmen Gias from The Sound of Jerry Rigg, Hauptgeschäftszeit, name of the track we heard. We opened that set with music from Nick Reisevic, 1970 recording entitled Head. Song we heard, Cannabis Sativa. My name's Scott. Thanks so much for listening. I will see you next week here on the Freeform Radio Station, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, worldwide, WFMU.org. I just saw Benjamin Walker blur past the security camera downstairs, so he must be booking his tail on up here to start his radio program, hopefully before Quebec Electric's Four on the Floor Bolero ends. I'm done. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you next week.
is going to describe how it feels for you to take a downer and how it feels for you to take an upper.
Okay, now let's talk about pills, all right? People take pills to get high, you see. Now, some pills are called downers. So, if we take a downer, it kind of makes us feel sleepy, and we think we feel good, like...
There, you're on a downer now. You've taken one, and now it's starting to react in your body, and now you feel like this. That's not much fun, is it? You thought you were gonna get high.
And I thought all of this was gonna work.
Very drowsy and sleepy.
You're listening to WFMU. My name's Benjamin Walker. We're in Studio B. Thanks to Scott Williams for holding the fort down as I stumbled in. Thanks to the path. But here we go. All right. This is the Too Much Information slot. We're still in our podcast freeform audio exploration stage for a few more weeks. And I unearthed something this weekend that I thought we would check out and listen to together. This is the one and only Alan Moore's Unearthing Project here on WFMU.
Along which channel the transforming energies leak in, foam downhill to engulf the capital. Julius Caesar's brief exploratory sortie during 55 BC had its first sight of the new principality from here, as did Agricola's more serious invasion force that followed later by almost a century. The same hushed apprehension of a vast and brilliant counterpane below, untidily tucked under at the far horizon, messy and unmade. The river's copper ribbon spooled across it, crumpling towards the east and settlements like biscuit crumbs. The three great woods, Jack, Castle, Oxley's, rolling up the hill in black iron wave fronts, smashing in a pale green spray across the peak and into Kent. Briefly, amongst its breathless fluid tumble of alarming images, the hill hallucinates a filigree of Roman ideology. A loosely outlined golden thread work stitched half-heartedly into the landscape's quilt, immediately unpicked, unravelled in a pungent, woolly tangle of New Saxon place names, Eltham, Charlton, Plumstead, Woolwich, Welling, Shetter's Hill. The road becomes a drover's track, an overloaded artery to pump the meat and money up. The massive herds a grubby, lousy scarf wound out along its length. The gas-fat crowbait fallen into wayside ditches blurs to grease and blowflies, melts into the rock dream's rush and flicker, the frenetic lantern show erupting in chalk scribbles, boiling clay out of a subterranean unconscious, flash frames in the blacked-out skull theatre of a buried Bronze Age god. Jet coral, London is accumulating. Squirms and grows in the detached gaze of the vantage. Royal successions in a strobe of ermine. On the Caltrack, swarming spectres crackle into being and as soon are vanished, blazing specks and filaments scratched white upon the film's emulsion. Out of Maying with one of his Catherines, Henry VIII attends a Robin Hood fair, Shooter's Hill as medieval theme park, and meets players dressed as Robin, Friar Tuck, Will Scarlet, Bashful, Goofy. Soon thereafter, Anne of Cleves crosses the hill and is immediately sent packing back the same way, failing to live up to the Hans Holbein PR package that preceded her. Archery ranges, smeared across the lower slopes towards the east, provide the shooters who will either give the hill its name or else will lend that name a spurious justification. And the 16th century whistles by, a rattling sideways rain of arrows. At the ragged edges of Elizabethan London's proto-psychedelic swoon, murderers blossom on the steep road's wooded margins. springing up around the base of the Armada beacon raised in 1588, cut purses ripening to cut throats, claret splashed across the turnpike, and, inevitably, a new nickname, Hill of Blood. A missing psychotronic flick from Herschel Gordon Lewis, William Castle. Agent Orange options are employed to thin the bandit cover. Come the 1600s, and the shearing of the hill commences, north side gradually reduced to roundhead stubble. Come the 18th century and building starts, the place's fever visions crystallised to lines and corners, brick growth thrusting through the shaven scalp, the coronet materialising one point at a time. First, inns arrive, providing watering holes for drovers, bolt holes for the highwaymen, and holes in general. Fanny on the Hill, the Catherine Wheel, Sun in the Sands, and then, in 1749, the crowning glory of the Bull. Palatial edifice erected on the summit with its glittering pleasure gardens, with its wells and fields and stables, its star chefs and its extensive cellars. Sumptuous hostelries and godlike view now make the dreaming hill itself a focal point for human aspirations, human dreams, as inns are followed by the follies, haunts and halls of hoobery-sozzled toffs groping towards Olympus. Princess Charlotte dwells at Shrewsbury House, face underlit a ghostly scarab green by bubbling glass retorts, a first stab at extracting gas from coal. A little further down the hillside to the east, in the still wooded reaches south of Watling Street, the widow of Sir William James raises a single turret castle, Sevenbury, in 1784, commemorating her late husband's naval victory over the pirate chieftain Conaghy Andrea at his Malabar coast seaport 30 years before. The tower looms up to peer between the treetops at the city spread below. Brass sight lines set into its wooden crow's nest rail, aligned with distant London monuments, with neighbouring counties, watching for the brigand hordes that may one day seethe from the backed-up drain of the metropolis, engulf the hill in rum, bum, concertina, cheap accessories. Just up the road, the Ligbird family are owners of the land on which the Bull is standing, with their stately pile broom hall next door and on the right. While at the hill's foot, by the gallows and the gibbet fields, are former Neolithic camps accumulating mass and muscle. The Royal Arsenal and Royal Artillery in Woolwich from the kick-off of the 18th century. Burned powder notes perfume the nagging westerly. Spark flintlock images of plunder, war and revolution in the free-associating stone subconscious, in its perilous delirious mix. Always a touchstone of imaginings and point of moonrise for the ancient settlements, their dead kings hulking from its turf, the heap attracts new fictions now. Already a collage of other men's exploits and novelists' inventions, the Dick Turpin story is attached to Shooter's Hill, the Essex boy misplaced in a confusion over rumoured hiding places deep in nearby woods. Then, at the century's end during the 1790s, Sydney Carton's Dover-bound coach founders in the mudslide up towards the brink, its passengers dismounting terrified on the notorious Blood Hill, made hysterically blind to the glaring facade of the Bull Inn, there at the peak for more than 40 years by then. The fictions come, and next the fiction mongers. During 1800, Wordsworth, barely 30, had his cottage overlooking Woolwich Common underneath the hill. And, as the villas of the middle classes start to fill the spaces between hilltop mansions in the early 19th century, Algernon Blackwood's future family home and birthplace buds amongst them. The new residents are prisoners in fairyland, commuters waiting for a train of neon roller girls to carry them, Starlight Express, into eternity. They line up at the mounting block, stood knee-deep in a fertile scurf of faltered social visions, different fictions, no less wistful. Shooter's Hill as healing spa or even enclave hilltop town, as site of a colossal pyramid, titanic mausoleum for the nation's titan dead. The slowly spreading actual homes and streets, unwittingly, invariably, sink foundations deep into a pre-existent dream crust. Steve Moore sleeps on wrinkled bedsheets made of sand beneath Silurian seas. He sleeps a dim, encysted mass within the glacier ice, or cradled in the highest boughs of prehistoric forest. Mumbling, he rolls over into servants' quarters in Broomhall's east wing before the walls dissolve, are realigned into those of the quiet semi he shares with his elder brother, with his goddess, with his books, his work. The closed eyes, wearing an absence of spectacles, a hand pressed bloodless, tingling between his knees, and worlds away, the woman next door's hall clock chimes another quarter hour with brisk and brass enthusiasm inappropriate to the drowsing moment. Aging paper perfumes stew and simmer at the threshold of awareness, and the soft trough between lower lip and front teeth silts with curds of mango pulp, its citrus flinch smoothed into a thick equatorial honey, sweet and rounded as a gogon buttock. Everything he is, his biologic destiny, his father's stroke approaching that eighth hole, blood histories, his code embroidered on the pillow's edge in spittle threads. Back in the 1880s, his paternal great-grandfather is in Dublin, putting down the Fenians. His granddad, born there in the barracks to a mortal term obscure and brief, ended in 1919 with his eldest son, 11-year-old Arthur James, becoming breadwinner. He never takes to Arthur, more a cleared throat than a name, preferring Jim. Hurries to work through Charlton's winter streets, head down, ears aching with the chill and mesmerised by his own schoolboy shoes, their rhythm on the pavement with its suede of frost, unable to believe this is his life. Frederick Burns, the company producing paper size in Belvedere there on the river, just past Plumstead, just past Welling. Panting with the pace, he leaves his breath behind him, frozen dragon embryos suspended in the dark and biting air. More than a decade later, Jim's still with the same firm when their fit new secretary starts, Winifred Mary Deeks, 9 years his junior, a tidy little bit of posh from the sedate, disputed borderlands where New Cross bleeds to Lewisham. She can't stand Winifred, all wisps and webs and spiders in the wedding cake, sticking with Mary. Delicate and lovely, paper in her blood, with printers somewhere in the background stir, and older brother Francis in naval intelligence, while younger sibling Donald works his way up through the ranks at Foyles, ends up as a distributor of academic publications specialising in the Orient. They're stepping out together before long, and Jim, with his own family tree, all gun cotton and powder burns, hardly believes his luck. They wed in 1937, and start looking for a place to live, somewhere that's safe and self-contained above the grime and hustle, and their eyes drift upward, inexorably, towards the hilltop, where the sky fast forwards into black and the full moon launches itself in ambush from behind the summit, flies up at the throat of night. They find their Desres in a muted cul-de-sac just opposite the melancholic front of the Memorial Hospital, erected circa 1920 on the site of the old Admiralty Telegraph, where windmill vanes once clacked their urgent semaphore. New house, one of those knocked up in the 30s where Broom Hall had stood. A previous owner bolted after 18 months, no reason given. Jim and Mary take up occupation there in 1938, a perfect fit with the Mrs. Dale's diary ambience. Peace and quiet. A cousin on the moor side of the family moved in next door, and forest just across the Dover Road, itself barely a murmur. Future stretched secure before them, and both of an age where all of this could still turn out to be a song, a Ronald Coleman film, a musical, Darby and Joan who once were Jack and Jill. The hopes and dreams come with the elevation. Then, within a year, so does the Luftwaffe. The Roman observation point is now the highest land between Berlin and London. Jim, his father's barrack room nativity just one twist further down the helical ancestral staircase, mans the rocket battery that's stationed on the golf course, uphill from the former gibbet fields. Phosphorus tracers hyphenating giant blackness, boom and siren, recoil shuddering the green, and distant firebursts pluming from the cower of the city. Their sole kill disputed, shared with other guns, the battery claims to have brought down only half a bomber. one-winged like a sycamore pod, just commencing its erratic, spiralling descent on London when the rockets hit. The pilot's startled profile, clearly visible in the exposed cross-section cockpit, open to an iron wind. Battle of Britain over with, the couple feel they can relax, allow themselves a modest and celebratory drink of future. First son Christopher arrives in 1943, spit of his dad, then 1944, and V-bombs, many of which fail to clear the hill. British intelligence is leaking fake reports to Germany of rockets overshooting London, hoping that they'll underestimate instead and hammer Kent rather than W1. Back on Shot Over Hill, there's charred gaps, sudden spaces in the uniformly 1930s rows where architectural incongruities will one day rise from scorched earth. Shooter's Hill becomes a surprise pot of bricks and offal at the far end of gravity's rainbow. Two doors down gets taken out while Jim is bathing. Bathroom ceiling comes down all in one piece, trapping him there in the tub, but sparing him the rain of roof and chimney that immediately follows. That could have so easily been that. Mary a single parent, Chris an only child, and all the wave of possibility to come collapsed there into suds and rubble on the sopping lino. Even with the war's end, understandably, the pair decide to wait and see if there are any more surprises. Nazi flying saucers piloted by Hitler's brain, Fourth Reich mole machines erupting through the pavement from the hollow earth beneath, before they risk another child. Stephen James Moore is born to a full moon on June the 11th, 1949, a crescent mark staining his forearm there upon the crescent hill. Gemini, like his brother, fire of air, the tarot knight of swords, the intellectual faculty in its most pristine and idealised aspect, almost mint condition on account of having been so seldom taken from its box and played with in the human mud. The corresponding tarot trump is number 6, the lovers, the alchemic principle of solve, or analysis, of separation. Name the baby Stephen with the name deriving from Stephane, a type of crown unusually favoured by Greek goddesses, most notably their lunar deity. His earliest memory is of September 20th, the next year, 1950, 15 months old, held up by his mother to look up the bright blue moon. This famous rarity occasioned by vast tracts of forest then ablaze in Canada. He will remember this for years, but as a dream, like floating slowly down the stairs into the hallway's umber, or the skeletal androgynous old woman, lower face concealed by a bandana, who unpeels into malign existence from the wardrobe door, abducts his hapless toys. Time is discreet from space until the eyelids close. He's snoring in the fourth dimension as a gorgeous fractal millipede. His limbs are frilly Muybridge roof, asleep on Duchamp's staircase. He's a Julia set, an emerald Gorgon fern unwinding from the luminous coelenterate complexity that is his mother, drifting there beside him in the grand fluid continuum. The albumen contained by space-time's egg. Dual coral, with his tail in the zygotic damp, his head cremated dust scattered across the Brinklow Crescent burial mound, he's a subsidiary offshoot coiling from the parent form, evolving its own crenellated intricacies but forever tied to the maternal Mandelbrot. Moored fast. Back in the captured heat of his terrestrial bed, one leg kicks out, dog basket reflex, and along the overbody's snaking flank, its insectile chaotic trim of arms and legs is rippled by a tiller girl convulsion. In suspension, monstrous in a lotus web above eternity, amid the gem anemones, he dreams his life. The awkward childhood, raised in low cloud up on the sequestered peak, and cringing at the stark immensities about him. The most lightless, smog-bound days were called black puddings. Is that dream or memory, that detail? Bawling from day one at nursery, singled out as best friend and primary prey by the 4-year-old sexual sadist who, as luck would have it, lives 2 doors away, is inescapable. With each attempt to integrate himself into the baffling social jigsaw, he discovers that his ears and mouth have fists in. Suffers military hazing rituals, punishment beatings, the full deep cut treatment from the Cubs. With nowhere left to go unless he wants a kicking from the Brownies, he removes to the interior, the private bone-walled Wendy house, the great indoors of books and small ventriloquistic wars to annex mantelpiece or carpet, solitary games. Excursions with his mother through the gleaming neon after dark, a thrilling adult land of purposeful, inscrutable activity adorned by burning smears of traffic light and Leslie Horbelicia's beacons. Down to the Granada Cinema in Welling, 1957, 9 years old, he wants to melt into the foyer's gold and crimson glow, into a lobby card dimension of hand-tinted slave girls, burnished gongs, oiled muscle men. Helen of Troy commences his obsession with Greek myth. The Iliad read by the age of 10, and then the hungry grey sponge in his head moves on from gods and legends to soak up the planets and the constellations named for them. Science, history, astronomy and classical mythology. In his retreat from fresh air and its various antagonisms, inadvertently he has become class SWAT, become more eminently punchable, practically begging for it. Or you, yes you, gig lamps. Then, escape, respite. He breezes his 11-plus exams and lands himself at Rowan School, traditional boys' grammar founded in Elizabethan times near Greenwich Park, a boffin undergrowth to throw off predators, to mask the telltale brainiac spore and lose himself within. Lunchtimes alone in the observatory, the Maritime Museum. Once discovered, fantasy is cultivated as a secret voice, a paediatric opium. Steve Reeves, Goliath and the Vampires after a preceding nudie featurette. That worn-out picture house in Lewisham, flypaper-coloured light, the kippered matron haunting the front booth. Retrieve the ticket from between her yellowed fingertips without skin contact. Mentally reciting a backdated birth year just in case, then downhill, following a weak tea spill of torchlight into rustling black. Science fiction, too, attracts him to its lurid, buzzing pylon. Man Against the Stars, a Margulies anthology of yarns reprinted from Astounding, only 2 and sixpence. Picked up like food poisoning while on a holiday in Guernsey. He divides himself between the academic analyst and pulp delinquent, a deliberate schism he will never see the need to mend. Failing to realise that his interest in the scientific has collapsed to a vestigial cover story for his fascination with the fictional, he's carried through his school days caught in the remorseless current of the science stream, passing 6 O-levels a year early, and then sluiced into a lab job, quality control at Rank Hovis McDougall, white-faced to find that at 16 he's a flower grader. This last year, since 1964, he's been attending meetings of the willfully progressive London SF group at someone's first floor flat in Kilburn. Moorcock is around. There's talk of making an experimental sci-fi movie from Charles Platt and Langdon Jones. And every week he rides the night train home with John Carnell, then editing New Worlds and nurturing its fledgling new wave, living just downhill in Plumstead. How has he descended from those crackling, inspiring heights to this? A mere laboratory hunchback, hair a dusty preview of its later self, pay packet burning less holes in his pockets than the everyday slop of sulfuric acid. He regrets his choice of occupation in a week, stays there for 18 months, his jeans eventually reduced to smoking lace. Even his first taste of a girlfriend, their eyes meeting over the retorts through a corrosive steam, is not enough to hold his interest. Barbara or Louise falls by the wayside, is supplanted by a new and more enduring passion, a new signal beamed from Uniceptor 4. Disappearing. Disconnecting all the visual cues that advertise the presence of a mind, a self that's here somewhere already hidden. One way this may be accomplished, a technique he's previously playground bully tested, is by standing still, ideally in some liminal location, in some threshold area, sheltering wall that edged the schoolyard, cavern, hilltop, city limit, spaces between world and underworld, skyline and sky, street lights and wilderness. Don't move. For almost 60 years, don't move. Stand still and turn to urban furniture, to your own monument, to landscape. Bypass all the cultural motion sensors. Become sub or supraliminal, white noise on the surveillance footage. In the country of the blind, the one-eyed man is king, and, better yet, invisible. Steve Moore sat in the armchair opposite his bed with ballpoint pen and notepad, spiral-bound, neat sloping capitals, each line a blue Q leaning forward, barely masking their impatience as the book-crammed room around him pales unnoticed into dusk there on the top of Shooter's Hill. Man with a foolish grin, perfectly still, as failing light adjusts to match his ash-slide hair, to match the wet slate gleam his skin has, the South London moon tan. Slowly the defining edge is lost in grey on grey, a photo undeveloping. The textures vanish in obliterating gloss, details excuse themselves. Fine wrinkles spreading from the corners of his eyes, curved up around the brow, curved down around the cheekbones, face like a magnetic field. All this erased and then the body outline fades, the slight frame that conspires with posture to seem even slighter, basically an Adam's apple and its support system. Melted, gone into the darkening of the cosy room, the man hutch with its pagan icon huddle. Finally, the only light is this of the metropolis. The great black garden of a million flowers on fire spreads supine and magnificent below his rear north-facing bedroom window. This and moonlight. Black on silver-dusted black, the hill pokes up its positive yang terminal into the night's electrolyte, plated across the centuries with urban dream in a metallic rind. Seabed before the ice age. Residues of fossil night sweat crown the tumulus, a cradle cap of gravel sheltering the clay and chalk beneath, while all around wore down to lowland. Marine aeons half remembered still in seaside decors that incongruously dot the closes and steep lanes. Its sickle-shaped mass crystal shot with Selenites rhomboidalis, Shooter's Hill is dreaming London up. Low on its northern slope, a chalk fault that collapsed, creating the Thames Valley, gouging out a life sump for the Neolithic swill to fill, the pallid Morlock scrum, chalk mining chavs blowing their barter on bone bling in settlements at Plumstead, Woolwich, barnacled below the Sleeping Hill's north flank. Part of a queasy hypnagogic swirl erupting from its moonstone synapses, the Stone Age shacks and faces flow like liquid, an accelerated morph seen from its geological perspective, turning into Bronze Age fishing villages and Trinovanti squints. Riffraff gets buried under middling heaps at Blackheath, kings and chieftains in great mounds up on the hilltop, sacred bulges on the hunched horizon. Five of these were flattened when they built the Lang Estate in the late 1930s, but still, one remains. A railed-off and grassed-over hump there at the junction of Plum Lane and Brinklow Crescent. Sole surviving god of Shooter's Hill, and also dreaming, underneath the yellow weeds. Down on the far side is the boundary where the dream ends. Kent begins, and London disappears. Back in the bedroom of the house where he's lived all his life, Steve Moore lies facing shelves of I Ching reference volumes, fast asleep on his right side so as to soothe that faltering gurgle in the ventricles, not half a dozen paces from the spot where he was born. Close to his face, upon a book-bare ledge, stands framed the gem-like miniature he painted during April 1989, a portrait of Selene, Greek moon goddess, Moon herself, naked and white, the sable-stippled cunt, the eyes and lips that seem to move beneath the glass, fogged by a silvery aerosol, his every night breath. There beside the picture rests the notepad and the ballpoint pen. Waking to dark or dawn stone blue, he'll scrawl his dreams down, key words, phrases, image prompts for later when they'll be typed up in full and added to the ring-bound stack, the log of an alternate life meticulously kept for more than 30 years, with earlier entries dating from his childhood, messages from otherworldly scientists with winsome daughters on the planet Uniceptor 4. Faint tremors in balloon-thin, eyelid skin betray the alien jostle taking place below, the nightlife. Skimming frictionless, his shoe soles half an inch above the paving slabs, he slips through lamp-lit streets, disturbing analogues of those he grew amongst, walks to this day. To lift the plain black cover of a dream file is to fretfully peel back a rectangle of tarmac from the skin of the locale, exposing a new stratum, laying bare a shadow neighbourhood beneath, and making audible the creepy chat of shadow neighbours, ghost train gossip, twilight ideologies. He dreams the hill with different weather and new cellars, giant roses hanging in the night sky over Plumstead, or pellucid covered markets under Blackheath. The unnerving day-deserted cul-de-sacs and the 8,000-year-old woodlands just across the humming road become the sets of strange pre-title sequences from Lost Avengers episodes. Diana Rigg, dead relatives and Hong Kong action movie stars move purposeful and sinister through semi-detached situations under lead skies. Elevator doors shrug shut before the lift slides sideways through unfathomable offices. Lovable horrors squirm, labouring towards the crest, sees roadside excavations of unearthly marble, massive buried architectures in a style he knows from somewhere, Greek or Babylonian Art Nouveau. He dreams a goat man, small and black, lounging insouciantly atop the back path's midnight hedge. He dreams his room. He dreams the 3x5-inch portrait of the goddess within misting distance of his slumbering lips. He dreams the hill. The hill dreams London. In 1985, he and his brother find one day they cannot wake her. And the morning that she didn't make, its pencil crayon light diffused on the unmoving eiderdown, death like her life demure, transacted without inconveniencing anyone. Mary, whom he took after. Every other night, she still calls from the kitchen in his dreams. The 80s burned down, guttering, with so much gone and melted. Westcliff woman, married with a kid. They still think of each other as good friends, but, well, you know. His mum's gone too. These stabilising female gravities, these planets breaking from his system, spinning off into the stars. The only woman who retains her influence upon him lives in Downing Street, is running down herself with supervillain tick in one eye. One hand, now a pincer, will be gone within a year. The spring gusts on the hill's brow have a sense of resolution, a brave melancholia, an urge to something as yet without form. For reasons that he only poorly understands, he has the sudden yen to dust off undeveloped drawing skills left on a high shelf since those early fanzine days, just for the exercise. Best start with something small. Small and erotic, to ensure that the enthusiasm needed to complete the project is maintained. Bogvilla's logic knows himself too well. He starts to paint the body of the goddess, of the female that he first encountered in 76, the foretold age of 27, couchant on a ground of turquoise night, naked except for her stéphane, her crown, the spill of auburn splashing down upon her breasts, her shoulders. She sits unself-consciously, her legs apart, déjeuner sur l'herbe. He tries to make her face that of his recently lost love, but here, the licked sharp brush refuses, cleaving to its own agendas. Diamond highlights animate the eyes, the gaze engaged, amused and up for trouble. For a while, her smile eludes him. Long nights, precious labour on her lips, the dawning knowledge that this graven image, this commandment breaker, is the seal of an insoluble commitment. After something like a week, she's finished. The addictive toil curtailed, contained within the narrow wooden limits of a prop-up frame to sit beside the armchair he makes notes in, on the desk he types at, by his bed. You saw me standing alone, without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own. The shape made by her limp white limbs becomes a tender rune, an ampersand belonging to an alphabet of greater passion, stronger meaning, drinking in the energy of his attention, of his writing, of his work, his sex, his sleep, until the framed glass hums with it, lenses the trapped vibrations back into the room's air pocket ambience, a high-pitched alpha drone on its periphery. Emotionally compressed, the bubble habitat heats up, exhibits sonoluminescence, starts to shine. Over the next few years, the sense of contact ebbs and flows, never recedes entirely, while he's busy with the US color version of Laser Eraser, earning, yearning, finishing trigrams of Ham and finding it a publisher on money that his mum has left, or grafting as a contract writer-editor for the going concern that Fortean Times, increasingly, has started to become. Viz magnate John Brown is the magazine's new publisher, its circulation rising as its genuinely interesting hardcore content dips. Its articles on lexical linkages or the psychometric scrying of American arcana shunted out in favour of X-Files-related cover features, rubber Roswell autopsies. A Bigfoot stumble, coughing in the dust of a bandwagon as it rumbles off to disappear forever into Area 51. Meanwhile, the postcard-sized framed portrait has become the portal where he stands and stares, replacing the grand panorama of the outer world beyond his bedroom window with its moonless view. She's there behind the glass, a different universe, just millimetres from his fingertips, with everything she represents. Divine light, the romance of sorcery. Aleister Crowley calls it a disease of language. Spot it from a mile off. The inflamed vocabulary, the light-headed syntax. Luckily, most of the population have been immunised by C.S. Lewis, Tolkien, J.K. Rowling, Buffy, by exposure to the virus in the form of a dead culture, something that will force no-nonsense antibodies to kick in without the danger of full-blown enchantment. Texts that act as disinfectant, language pasteurised for ordinary consumption, all the ontological blue mould scraped off, the strange loops of self-reference, the pathogens, words so far past their best-before date that they're cruel, they're alive. Virulent rhetoric is thus prescribed. No dirty intercourse allowed except for those professions where hot contact cannot be avoided. So, effectively, magic becomes less a disease of language, more an occupational complaint of writers. Stirring cloudy coffee at the tea rooms tucked away in Castle Woods, where Golden Dawn old boy Algernon Blackwood's family home once stood, he knows it's already too late for him, already in his bloodstream. He's high risk, susceptible, OTO positive. The I Ching work and covert goddess worship, markers of occult predisposition. Warily investigating, he affiliates himself in 1992 to a magical order, the Illuminates of Thanateros, Temple and New Cross Recording Studio. Chaos magic, though the name seems a bit harsh. Bit of a mess at worst, more teen goth's bedroom than inchoate pre-creational abyss. He chants along with all the others for a while, recalls his lip-synced prayers at school assembly, then has the temerity to inquire of an order head if there's a reason why the ceremonial robes have to be black. Is told, in lieu of answer, that it shows colossal ignorance to even ask. God, what if everyone questioned the most basic principles of ritual like that? It'd be chaos. Clearly not for him. This warmed-over Austin Osman spare without requirement to tread too close to the edge of the apocalyptic Brixton artist shaman's risky line. He holds out for a month or two, then jacks it in, though not without a certain fidgety dissatisfaction, an impatience with the numinous. You get all dressed up and she doesn't show. You turn up at the Juju showroom to take magic for a test drive and can't get it off the lot. while all the senior salesmen stand around and suck their teeth. Maybe it hasn't got an engine. Maybe that whole internal combustion thing was only crazy talk. And yet, the promise in her eyes, behind the glass, beside the bed. There must be more to wizardry than this. This Gandalf with his knob-pierced stuff. Where's the romantic rush? The Blake ache? Where's the art? At this point, the narrator, up to now concealed behind the safety curtain trying to keep out of it, must advertise his presence with a cough, without allowing this to turn to a John Silence story, to a yarn where the intrepid House on Haunted Hill investigator is reluctantly, predictably drawn in and made a witness to the awful outcome, to the vanishing, the giant hand from beyond. I've been along with him for most of the above, entranced and fascinated, following his lead, convinced that the smart money was on this unlikely scarecrow. All about Eve, him as Betty Davis. Follow him into the drug fug of the 60s underground and through the Fortean ruminations of the 70s, into the comic writing thing, his red corrections, vivid and instructive lacerations on those first trial scripts 25 years back. In the early 90s, with a three-lane pile-up of a marriage still receding in the rearview mirror, following him into magic seems a good idea. A way to steer the vehicle of writing off the speedway of career into fluorescent wasteland. His forays in organised contemporary magical society, all his new cross necromantic nights are watched with interest. Let's see if this sends him mad or kills him before making any personal investment. Sharing his frustration and his disappointment when it fizzles out without result. Late night conversations as to what a genuinely modern magic worldview might entail. More literary and progressive. Texts to represent the body of the god that may in some way then be treated or manipulated. Set, Osiris, Burroughs, Geesin. Two cut-up techniques, somehow reduced to one. The psilocybin dialogues blithely wandering through riff, hypothesis and rant towards a hidden precipice.
So that was a series of excerpts from the writer, thinker, magician, Alan Moore. It's his unearthing project about his friend, Steve Moore, who basically spent his life about four paces from the spot where he was born. An attempt at psychogeography. Alan Moore is most famous for writing Watchmen, V for Vendetta. And as the bad comic book companies continue to capitalize on his name, I do imagine him sometimes sitting in his little room with the fireplace going, just pouting, staring at his typewriter, seething. But as all these third-rate cartoonists' hands start falling off, losing their limbs, we'll see who gets the last word. You know, I found a few documentaries on Alan Moore a few years ago. Old BBC stuff. You can find them on the internet. Highly, highly recommended. So we're in Studio B. My name's Benjamin Walker. This is the Too Much Information slot being filled with various odds and ends for a few weeks. But we're coming up on marathon time. Only 2 weeks a year does WFMU do this. And the band is getting ready to rehearse all the songs they'll be doing at the finale, which will be here in our newly excavated first level. So we do hope you'll be generous and remember your favorite radio station as we take to the airwaves to solicit your support. All that coming up in a few weeks. Radio Free Culture will be here next week, so I will see you at Marathon Time. And you can stay tuned for Nardwuar coming up next.
You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, in Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Up next, the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette Radio Show.
Present the Checkmates LTD.
All right, let's get it on. That's all right, that's okay. Well, all right. Hey, mama, don't you do me wrong. Come and love your daddy. All night long, honey, that's all right. Baby, that's all right. See the lady with the dress on. She can
shake her tail feather.
She does it all night long. Honey, that's all right. Baby, that's all right. When you see me in misery, I must be
outside.
In Mississippi now. But that's all right. Baby, that's all right. Tell your mama and your pa, she's gonna
have a color son-in-law.
But that's okay, baby, that's all right. Oh, tell me what I say, baby, what I say. Hey, baby, tell me what did I say now. Oh, baby, what I say, oh, baby, what I say. Here we go now, oh, oh,
oh.
Oh, oh, baby, please, come on. Please. That's all right. Hey, baby. Because I feel all right. And I feel all right. And I feel all right. Once again, now, Mary.
What's up?
Mary.
You don't know about me.
Please.
Please.
Come on. Why not?
You're
coming,
that's why.
That's okay. Hey, baby. I feel all right. And I feel all right. And I feel all right. Can I get a witness? Can I get a witness? I need a witness. I need a witness. I need a witness. I need a witness. We like bread and butter. We like toast and jam. What my baby needs me, cause I'm a loving man. We like bread and butter. And we like toast and jam. What my baby needs me, and I'm a loving man. Hold it. Sock it to me.
sit on my knee. And little bitty pretty one, I'd like you to know, love it, I'm the lovely one, I've been watching you grow. He runs in the treetops all the day long, singing that song. The birds on Jaybird Street, the robin go tweet, 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 rockin' robin, rockin' robin. I said, oh, rockin' robin, and I'm really gonna rock tonight one more time. The wild old owl, the big black crow, go bird, go. Every chickadee, rockin' robin, rockin' robin. I said, oh, rockin' robin, and I'm really gonna rock tonight, yeah. One, two, three, look at Mr. Lee. Three, four, five, look at him shine, Mr. Lee. Oh, Mr. Lee, 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 Mr. Lee. Everybody, one, two, three, look at Mr. Lee. Three, four, five, look at him shine, Mr. Lee. Oh, Mr. Lee, 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 Mr. Lee. Everybody loves a lover. I'm a lover. In Detroit, they don't love me. But anyhow, that's how I feel. While I feel, call me something Italian. Something for real. Real Italian. That's a lot better.
And you're listening to WFMU, and it's time right now for the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette Radio Show. You just heard right there the Checkmates LTD with medley from the Live at Caesar's Palace LP from 1967. Today on the Nardwuar to Human Serviette Radio Show, an interview with, from Orlando, Florida, XXYY. XX. Yes, an interview with Marcel XXYYXX. Right now, gonna play something by Zounds What Zounds. It's an LP by Dan Elliott and his big band. Gonna play the track, listen for the crazy zounds, could be a cement mixer in there. Will You Still Be Mine? Gonna follow that up with Donna Lynn with Java Jones. But right now, gonna start the Nardwuar to Human Serviette Radio Show with Sylvester, I Need Somebody to Love Tonight. Then we're gonna hear Zounds What Zounds, Dan Elliott and his big band, and then Donna Lynn, Java Jones. And then an interview with, from Orlando, Florida, XXYYXX. Here's Sylvester on the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette Radio Show on the station known as WFMU.